this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 24th, 2010, and this is show number 242. Well, this is an action-packed show today. I hope you have lots of time to listen. We've got two listener reviews, one from Klaus and one from Mark, another Vector drawing package review, and Chit Chat Across the Pond has two main topics on top of a ton of security light. So we better not fool around. Let's get started. Well, first of all, this is one of the very last reminders. If you're going to Macworld, be sure to send me an email so I could send you to the NoCilla Castaways Google Calendar. I have settled on a meetup date and place. We're going to go to Jillian's, which is right around the corner from the place where the show is being held, Moscone Center. And it's going to be around 6 o'clock, 6:30, something like that, right after the last big event on Thursday. I'll give more details to the folks who sign up for the calendar, so be sure to let me know if you're going to be there. Well, I've been using Windows 7 for a couple of months now, and I have a confession to make. I don't think I hate Windows anymore. Now, that might just be because I was sick a couple of weeks ago and it was raining last week, but you know, at first I thought it was that I just don't hate it as much as I hated Vista, but I think I'm actually kind of starting to enjoy myself. I move from office to office, plugging into different monitors that are oriented differently, say one of them side to the side, one's above, that sort of thing. Well, this week I left my office where the monitor's above, and I went back to an office that had it off to the side, and I hadn't been to that office in probably a month. And darn it, if Windows 7 didn't remember exactly the way I like to extend the desktop on that monitor. Now, as you'll recall, this was very poorly implemented in Vista. It was like a good 5 minutes of fiddling every time you plugged into a different monitor, and sometimes it would even randomly change resolutions or switch to mirrored mode when I wasn't even touching it. I am very, very happy with Windows 7 on how it deals with external monitors. I love how it sleeps when I tell it to. It's not quite as easy as on a Mac where I can just slam the lid shut, but at least when I tell it to sleep on my Windows 7 laptop, it actually obeys me. It works every time. Now, it does take a lot longer to come back up than OS X. I think it goes into kind of a deep sleep if you leave it for an extended period, so it does have to resume Windows first. It's like 20 seconds or so to come back up. It might actually be saving me battery, though, because I know my Mac, when it's asleep, it's still doing something because it drains it pretty fast. Anyway, what I love is that Windows 7 does not turn itself back on in my backpack and heat itself up to, say, 236 degrees unbeknownst to me. That happened a bunch with Vista. I actually really like the taskbar now. I like how if you click on an application's icon, it shows you all of the open windows. From there, you can click on the one you want and even selectively close other windows without actually opening them full screen. OS X does a lot of that with the dock, but there's kind of a slight hesitation before it kicks in, and for some reason that delay is enough to make me not instinctively use the dock to do that. I love how fast applications open in Windows. Now, that's always been true. On the Mac, I have a dreadful habit of keeping about 26 applications open at once because many applications take forever to launch. Aperture, for example, which is an Apple application, it takes forever. Heck, it takes forever to quit, too. iPhoto comes up fairly quickly, but it won't let you actually get started for a really long time. I always wondered why people who were using Windows would quit the application even if they were going to open them again in just a few minutes. But now I know why. There's virtually no penalty to quitting and reopening. I watched a woman looking for a picture to show me. She'd open an image, quit the application, open the next image, relaunching that app, and then quit again. She did it that way because there was zero time impact for her to do that. Some applications on the Mac are snappy to open. I do open and quit Bean pretty quickly, my favorite free text editor, because it's so fast, there's no penalty. But I gotta tell you, even my beloved Feeder takes about 4 seconds till I can start writing again, and that's just way too much time to waste. Now, I am still very annoyed at text selection on Windows 7. I find it very difficult to select sections of text, especially in a web browser. I mostly use Firefox on Windows, and consistently when I try to grab just a paragraph, it selects the entire darn web page. Selecting just a word is problematic too. In Microsoft Word, for example, it always tries to select the word before my selection. It's not uncommon for me to take 4 passes before I get the word I actually want. Another area of pain in text selection is renaming files during Save As. I do a lot of work in Camtasia Studio on Windows, and when I hit save on a file, it shows the file name as something or other .camrec, C-A-M-R-E-C, six letters. If I click to change it, it selects the entire name, meaning if I start typing, I'll have to type .camrec again. Pretty annoying. So now I have to hit the right arrow, which takes me to all the way seven characters from where I want to be. So I have to hit the left arrow seven times to get over, then the backspace, however many characters it's put in the default name. I guess I should use the left arrow to start, but I'm so used to the right arrow on the Mac taking me to the right point before the dot. I don't know. It's very, very annoying. It's too hard. I do actually still find some problems in the, I'm going to call it Finder, what is it called, the Explorer window. The way things open and close, and it's harder to put stuff into the sidebar there, that's kind of annoying. But overall, I got to tell you, I'm not hating Windows. So I guess the bottom line is, I'm Allison, and I'm a PC. Okay, the chat room is just screaming at me right now. It's they told me not to save because I was saying nice things about Windows, so... Yeah, that really irritated him. So that was a good thing. Well, Tim Verporten of the Mac ReviewCast just bought a Zoom H2, the great portable mic that I use that records to SD cards. I use mine all the time for interviews at conferences in particular. One day a few years ago, I was on Uvu, and Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast was on, and I noticed this giant black ball in front of his face. I questioned what it was, and he pulled the foam wind filter off of his Zoom H2. I was kind of confused, and he explained that he was using the Zoom H2 as a USB mic. I was still confused because I didn't know you could use it as a USB mic. I'd owned it for a couple of years and didn't know that. He taught me how to do it way back then, and then Tim asked me this week how to do it. I thought it might be most useful to do it in video. So I created a video and posted it on YouTube, and I've embedded the video in the show notes if you're interested. I'll also, if hopefully I'll remember to do this, I will permanently put it in my tutorial section on the website. Klaus from MacTopics.de sent in a review of the Powerline Network Adapter Kit he just got from Devolo.com. He said he's not sure if it's available in the U.S., but I figure, heck, it's about time the Americans got teased and heard about something they can't have instead of the Europeans or Australians for once. Now, it might be available in the U.S., but I still thought that. Anyway, here's his review.
Hello, this is Klaus of the MacTopics.de podcast, calling in from across the pond. Today I would like to provide a quick review of the Devolo DLAN 200 AV Plus Starter Kit, a home plug AV compatible kit to create a local area network via the power cables off your home, a system also known as Powerline Network. Let's get started with the problem to solve. My internet connection is located in my office, which is in the basement of the house I live in. Despite utilizing a 802.11n router, my iMac upstairs had a very slow connection and kept dropping the connection at will. That did, of course, annoy the hell out of my wife, and like every good husband, I set out to find a solution. I considered a few options, some involving drilling massive holes and laying lots of good Ethernet cable, and in the end, I decided to try this home plug AV-based system as it seemed to provide the best chance of success for my particular setup, and I really didn't want to have a conversation with my landlord about drilling holes in his ceilings. So how does it all work? Basically, you get two massive power bricks in the kit, two short Ethernet cables, ACD, and a very brief printed quick setup guide. Setup is amazingly simple, though before you get started, take a moment and note down the MAC address and the security code of both adapters. They will come in handy later. So this is how to set up this network. Plug the Ethernet cable into your router and then into the adapter. Then plug the adapter into the power socket of your wall. Now take the second adapter, plug in the Ethernet cable into your computer and the adapter, and then plug that adapter into the power socket in your wall near your computer. Done. Now, I personally didn't believe it could be that simple, but it was. This was simpler than setting up a Wi-Fi router where you're supposed to think about encryption and you end up entering massive codes into your router and then your Mac. To be honest, you should think about encryption on your new Powerline network for a second and then dismiss that thought and simply press the teeny tiny button next to the Ethernet port on the adapter. Now you're done. Well, if you want more control, go ahead and put in the CD and launch the DLAN assistant, and it will recognize the power line adapter attached to your computer, and then you can type the security code of the other power line adapter and set your own network password. It's a bit more control for those who really like that control, but I'm not sure it makes a big difference. So that was painless, but what is my impression so far? I seem to be very lucky that the cabling in my house isn't horribly old, and thus I get really good speed. According to the adapters, it should be good enough for HD streaming, though I have no real need to test this out. To me, the solution is to get my office internet reliably to my iMac upstairs, and most importantly, to make my wife happy. The 802.11n router has failed me and brought lots of latency and slow connections, and my internet experience feels a lot snappier now. Speedtests via speedtest.net show that I'm now getting the full speed that my DSL line is bringing to my home. While the marketing folk at Devolo promise you 200 megabits per second speed, I wouldn't even dare to hope that this is the speed I would get. Just like Wi-Fi, those are test laboratory values that no one will ever achieve. Though for my purposes, things are good. They are very good indeed. If your aim is to send lots of huge files across your home network, you might want to think about a proper Ethernet-based LAN, as this will give you the best speeds without a doubt. If you already have a Wi-Fi network and you have no issues, I don't think you should waste your time to think about this one. But if you have a computer in an area of your house where you have no connection or very little connection, well then this might be just the perfect solution for you. Thanks for the great show and keep that ever so slight Macintosh bias. We're loving it.
Well, thanks, Klaus. This was fantastic. I've been curious about powerline networking, but I've never met anyone who had actually bought one, so it's great to know that it works so well. I will keep that in mind for the future. We have another listener review. This one's from Mark Pauly, and he's going to tell us about Mac Gourmet.
Hi, Allison. This is Switcher Mark in Seattle with a review of one of my favorite Mac programs, Mac Gourmet. It can be found at macgourmet.com. I know you probably aren't familiar with this problem, but anyone that cooks much has their favorite recipes scattered about multiple cookbooks, clippings, and scraps of paper with ingredients and instructions scribbled on them. As you can imagine, it's pretty easy for recipes to get damaged, and I can't tell you the number of hours I've spent trying to find a misplaced recipe or remember just which cookbook I read something in. The developers describe Mac Gourmet as iTunes for your recipes. Mac Gourmet helps you create and edit recipes, easily browse your entire recipe collection, import recipes from the web, and develop shopping lists. The default interface, called the Recipe Box, looks a lot like iTunes or the Finder. On the left is the main navigation pane that includes all of the file locations, sections to store cookie notes and wine notes, and user-created lists, which are like playlists in iTunes for special subsets of recipes. Your recipes are located in My Recipes. With My Recipes highlighted in the left-hand pane, an alphabetical list of recipes appears in the right, with a preview pane below that. There are several ways to view and print your recipes in Mac Gourmet, but my favorite is called Chef View. Click on the big picture of a chef hat on the application bar, and a separate full-screen window opens, showing the ingredients and cooking directions in large, easy-to-read text. In this view, I can read the recipe directly from my computer in the kitchen, but keep my precious MacBook at a safe, slop-free distance. While Mac Gourmet comes with several recipes already in its recipe box, its real value comes when you input and organize your own recipes, and the program has several methods to do just that. There's a simple and intuitive recipe editor for typing your existing recipe collection into the program. The editor allows you to include recipe name, source, serving size, and other general information for indexing the recipe. Ingredient input is easy, and the editor is smart enough to recognize the measurements or ingredients you're typing and offers to auto-complete the entry for you. I found this to be really accurate, and it saved me a lot of typing. Along with preparation directions, you can also include nutritional notes and a picture. Mac Gourmet also has two really useful methods to import recipes. The first method is to create a text clipping. This allows you to bring text from any document into Mac Gourmet. I've successfully imported text from web pages, email, word processing documents, and PDFs. If you can get a good enough scan of a printed recipe, you can even transfer that text as a clipping. Text is transferred with a simple drag and drop, cut and paste, or by using the built-in Mac OS X services automation. Text clippings are imported into the Recipe Import Assistant, which offers a simple tool to then move the text into the appropriate locations in the recipe editor. The process is easy and fairly accurate, although I did find an occasional error transferring ingredients. Mac Gourmet also has a powerful tool to gather recipes from cooking websites. Mac Gourmet supports direct import from 11 of the most popular sites, and the developer says they will continue to add plugins for other sites. The importing process couldn't be easier and uses a built-in OS X services automation. Just go to a supported site. I use Food Network all the time. Find a recipe you want, highlight the page's URL in the browser address bar, and then activate the OS X service. All of the recipe information appears in its proper location in the Recipe Assistant, even if Mac Gourmet was not open. The process is quick and very accurate. As my collection of recipes in Mac Gourmet grows, I'm finding that its robust search function is extremely useful. I am able to find recipes by name, course, ingredient, and many other search fields. There are also some really creative search tools. For instance, if I know what ingredients I have on hand, but I can't decide what to cook, I can do what's called a cupboard find. I just input the ingredients I have on my cupboards into the special search fields, and Mac Gourmet suggests the recipes that utilize those ingredients. Mac Gourmet also provides tools to share recipes. You can easily export a recipe as an email, but more impressive is the ability to publish recipes as a web page or a blog entry. You supply the program the necessary information to publish to MobileMe or another hosting location or your blog. There are also several nice templates for formatting the pages. I've used this function to publish some of my favorite recipes for friends and family. With just a few commands, Mac Gourmet formatted and uploaded my selected recipes to my MobileMe account. Now I can give people the address to my published cookbook or link to it from my own webpage. Visitors to the page can print the recipes or download them to their own Mac Gourmet library. The page looks great and works really well. Want a shopping list to take to the store with you? Just drag a recipe onto My Shopping List in the left-hand navigation pane, and it's automatically created for you. An iPhone app makes this even easier. You can transfer your recipes and lists via Wi-Fi from your computer to your iPhone. The Mac Gourmet website includes several in-depth screencasts that explain the program better, and forums to share ideas and recipes. Mac Gourmet is $24.95. Plugins are sold separately that allow you to create meal plans, perform nutritional analysis, and create PDF cookbooks. Or you can purchase Mac Gourmet Deluxe for $49.95 that includes the entire package. The companion iPhone app is $4.99. Well, that's it for now. I can't wait to meet you and the other Nozilla castaways at Macworld.
Thanks for a great review, Mark. It's almost enough to make me want to actually cook something. Almost, of course. Mac Gourmet sounds like a great Mac product, and it seems like they've thought of absolutely everything. I especially like the idea of the formatting being big and clear enough that you can keep your laptop at a slop-safe distance. Thanks, and I can't wait to meet you at Macworld. That's going to be fun. Well, you know I love screen steps, and that I bother everyone I know about how much fun it is to use to make great documentation. I was listening to the Nightcast a while ago, and on episode 24, he was talking about how you can free yourself by using applications that are cross-platform. That way you can use Linux, the Mac, a Windows box. It can stop being a religious war, and you can just love the one you're with. I like this approach, and it's one of the great selling points of ScreenSteps because it does work on both the Mac and the PC. But as I listened to Nightwise Philosophy, it did bother me that ScreenSteps wasn't available on Linux too. The guys over at ScreenSteps have taken the first tiny, teeny little baby steps towards getting ScreenSteps going on Linux. They have an experimental version ready for people to bang on. I think they're nervous about this path because they refer to this experimental ScreenSteps for Linux beta as, and I'm quoting, a version of ScreenSteps that mostly works on Linux, but with no guarantee that we will ever release a final version. Our goal with this release is to gauge interest in a Linux version, see if ScreenSteps works reasonably well on the different flavors of Linux out there, and get feedback from Linux users. So if you're a Linux user and you'd like to have a fabulous documentation tool at your fingertips, I suggest you follow the link in the show notes to download this experimental version and give these guys some feedback. Tell them what you think. They're very responsive, and I think it could help make a great product if you guys like it and if you guys go play with it and if you write to them. Until that gets rolling with your enthusiastic support, remember, you can buy Screen Steps for Windows and Mac for only $40, but with the 25% off coupon code NOSILLA, my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, it's only $30 for the standard version. Heck, for $80 and then take off 25% off, that'd be $60, you can get the pro version. Splurge on yourself. Head on over to screensteps.com and give their 30-day free trial a try. Last week, I reviewed a vector drawing program called Intaglio, and I loved it. However, during the live show, Gita suggested that there are better vector drawing programs out there. I think maybe she's not old enough to remember MacDraw, and so for her, it was not an intuitive program to use like Intaglio was for me. Anyway, I said, put up or shut up. What else should I try? So she sent me a long list of tools. Today, I'm going to review one of her candidates, a product called DrawIt, from bohemiancoding.com. DrawIt is a very different interface from anything I've worked with before. Everything is in one window, no floating palettes or anything like that. The center of the window is where you draw. The left side pane is a list of your layers, and every object you draw is by definition on its own layer, or actually is its own layer. The right side pane is my favorite part of DrawIt. It's called Special Attributes. It's where you stack up attributes you apply to a given layer. Attributes are things like color fill, shadows, Gaussian blur, gradients, all kinds of different effects you can apply. The thing to love about this pane is that you move these stacks up and down, changing the order in which the attributes get applied. Graphically, it reminds me of automator actions, if you've ever seen those. To apply an attribute to a layer, you click the little pencil icon at the bottom and choose the one you want. If it's an attribute you think you might use often, you can make it a favorite. Once it's a favorite, you have a nice little bin of favorites down at the bottom, and you can just simply drag and drop those onto a stack, applying it to your selected layer slash object. I had a lot of fun adding text and dropping a shadow favorite on it. And DrawIt gives you so many fun options. You can drag sliders to move the shadow all over the place, change the blur radius, change the color of the shadow. It's all real time as you drag the controls around. Really, really fun. To add objects to the drawing, you click a button entitled Insert and then choose from a list of some usual suspects, like regular shapes plus text, images, and vector. I'll get into vector later. Once you've inserted a few objects, you see a list of their names on the layer menu down the side. I like this way of working. It's easy to select objects by their name, oval, text, or shape, for example. Of course, as you get a lot of layers down, I suppose that wouldn't be too practical. But it's easy to drag them up and down to change the layer order instead of doing things like the traditional right-click, arrange, send to back, send forward, that sort of thing. Having it be able to drop exactly where you want it is actually easier this way. What feels kind of unnatural to me is how you group layers. Instead of the more common right-click group, you first use that same insert button and choose empty group, and then you drag the layers into the group. For some reason, each time I did that, the items I'd group jumped to a new location on the drawing. Since I was just goofing around, that wasn't a big deal, but I can imagine if I had carefully constructed a group of objects, and just by grouping them, they flew across the page, I'd be pretty bummed. I think that might actually be a bug. Once I set up groups, I found the overall behavior of DrawIt to be compromised. Things that were easy to select before the groups were selected were no longer easy to select and modify. The process I just described is how the help file said to group objects, but then I noticed there's two buttons at the top that said group and ungroup. Very good visual icons, too. You could tell that's what they were supposed to do. It was much more natural to use those buttons. Not quite sure why the help file told it to do that weird, you know, create insert empty group thing. That was kind of strange. The buttons worked perfectly. DrawIt exhibited some very odd behavior when working groups that I never did understand. Sometimes, not all the time, when I was selecting a group, the whole drawing would go dimly gray except for a rectangular area with a yellow border. I have no idea what that box was. It wasn't even where the group was that I just created, but it was clearly associated with the group I was messing with. Very disconcerting, and I'm not sure what it was for. Another unnatural process is how you zoom. The usual Z keystroke doesn't enable a magnifying glass. Instead, you have to type in a magnification number in a small area at the bottom of the screen or hit the plus minus button to zoom. Not even a slider. I know that it's not that hard, but it's just too many steps. Because then you have to scroll to get to the area you want to see because you haven't just been able to hit Z and drag across an area. That traditional Z and magnifying glass lets you zoom and select what you're zooming in on one step. In case it's not obvious, all editing and draw it is non-destructive. I think nowadays we're beginning to really expect that, but I still do appreciate it. DrawIt has one very unique feature. If you click on an object slash layer and you hold down Alt-Command-P, DrawIt will show you the width, height, and distance from the edge of the drawing. It's kind of cool. The existence of these dimensions is a toggle. They stay on until you hold down Alt-Command-P again. So you've got this one object selected and it's showing its dimensions. Now, if you hover over a second layer slash object, you'll be treated with the dimensions from your first object to your second object. All right, it doesn't sound like a treat to you the way I described that, but it really is pretty cool when you see the dimensions jump on screen. I really like the way it was done. Another attribute I enjoyed of DrawIt was the ability to edit bitmap layers in an external editor. That's a fancy way of saying take a picture, like a screen snapshot, drop it into DrawIt, and then if you want to modify that image, you can click on it and select Edit in External Editor, and it'll open the image in your default pixel editor. In my case, I use the fabulous Acorn from flyingmeat.com. That's my external editor of choice, and DrawIt automatically chose Acorn to edit my embedded images. Maybe this doesn't sound important, but it's really cool. I should have mentioned, in order to get images into DrawIt, you simply use my brother Kelly's favorite Mac function, drag and drop. Kelly was always telling me, always try drag and drop first, and you'd be amazed at how often that works. I thought, no, I know about drag and drop. I mean, I practically invented drag and drop, but I wasn't dragging and dropping as often as I actually could. After he told me that, I started trying it everywhere, and it is amazing. Anyway, I worried about doing this review quite a bit because while I'm quite adept at testing out most mainstream applications, I had this vague nagging in the back of my mind that my inability to get the whole vector part of this had something to do with my complete and utter lack of training in doing graphic design. I tried to understand the way the tools worked, but not even understanding what a vector is supposed to do or what I should do with things like gradients to make images come alive like real objects was hampering my ability to actually do a perfect review of this project because I had a lot of trouble with vectors. I couldn't get them to do anything that I wanted to do. It was kind of a mess. Well, luckily, right before I completed my professional assessment, I happened to go to a rather generic link on the bohemiumcoding.com website, and I noticed at the bottom there's some little video clips. I watched the one where the demonstrator creates a little cube, and he puts wood grain on the three sides so you can view it. And then they add gradients to set the lighting. That's when I realized, I don't know, squat about how to make art with a vector design tool like DrawIt. So if you actually understand vector drawing programs and you're looking for something, I think DrawIt is a pretty good competitor, even though I don't actually understand how to use the more subtle pieces of it. DrawIt will run you 29 euros, which is only $38 US, for a vector drawing program that is not very expensive. So I think you should go to the bohemiancoding.com website and try it out. That is, if you have a clue how to create art on a computer. Well, I think I mentioned last week that I bought a new iPod unit for my car. Steve had put in the very first one I had, but it didn't work very well with the new iPods and iPhones. It was time for an upgrade. For most people, this means either spending hours doing it themselves or taking their car to a place like Best Buy and leaving it for a day. But I had a better idea. I had Honda Bob come over and do it. You know how this kind of thing goes, right? You pull one set of screws only to find you have to take another part of the car out and then another one, and then you scrape your knuckles and then you swear for a while and then you yank and you pull and you argue with it. You've been there, right? Eventually, you do get it back together only to find out you forgot a part or it isn't quite fitting together right anymore. I'm not saying it's easy when Honda Bob does it. It's just as hard, It's just that we're puttering around the house enjoying ourselves while Honda Bob is swearing and scraping his knuckles. While Bob was working on my car, Steve said to me, "I'm so glad it's him under there and not me." If you don't believe me, I put a picture of Honda Bob up to his elbows inside my dash in the show notes. Honda Bob, of course, did a fabulous job and kept at it until it worked perfectly. You might need engine work, or your McPherson struts need to be replaced, or you need an entire transmission rebuilt, or maybe you just want a new iPod dock. Whatever it is, on your Honda or Acura, you want Honda Bob to be the one doing the heavy lifting. If you don't live in the LA or Orange County areas of California, I feel badly for you because you can't call Honda Bob. But if you do, give him a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's in my favorite time of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm mostly good, but like you, suffering from a little bit of a head cold. Dolores Umbridge, is it?
I think so. Hey, I thought it was kind of funny. This morning, you and I were comparing temperatures, and it was actually the same temperature here as it was in Ireland.
Yeah, then it occurred to me afterwards that that was our daytime maximum, and it was your morning first thing temperature.
Actually, I didn't tell you, but that's Steve told me to point that out to you, and I said, no, I've done enough slapping people around about weather. But, man, we had, I am not joking, we measured it in our backyard, 5 inches of rain in 5 days.
Wowzers. How did your country not flood? You guys are not used to that.
No. In California, our yearly average is like 12 inches, something like that. I need to check that, but it was pretty extraordinary.
Close to half. Yeah,
in 5 days.
Half year's rain in 5 days. Jesus, that's pretty severe. The only severe weather we've had today is we had a fog that just didn't lift. It was just there in the morning, still there at noon, still there now.
Yikes. All right, well, at the danger of getting into this week in weather, let's start out. What do we got for security light today, Bart?
Oh, goodness, I better take a deep breath before diving into this one.
It might wasn't be security you, medium dense.
Yeah, wasn't it you who said a few weeks ago, oh, it's all very quiet on the security front? Well, someone heard you.
My fault. My bad.
Right. So, this doesn't seem to have made big waves, but I came across it on one of my RSS feeds, and there seems to be an unpatched flaw in QuickTime with the playing of .mov files. So if someone randomly emails you a .mov file, you probably should consider it twice before you run it, because it's a possible attack vector. Maybe be careful about opening mobs on the internet. Other than that, there's not really much you can do since you can't patch. So you just got to be wary of mob files, I guess, is the takeaway from this one.
Just in case anybody's not following what he's saying, he's talking about .mov files. I've never heard him called mob files.
No, we all call them that here, but maybe we're just weird.
There you go. Okay, so this one is a little bit in the not security light because there's nothing we can do except be cautious.
Well, yeah, but that's important.
Yeah.
Great. It's a file type you should be suspicious of.
But that's just the warm-up act.
So last week we had Act 1 of the IE saga, where we mentioned the existence of a zero-day in Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8. And we mentioned that it was slightly harder to exploit in 7 and 8. And I don't know if he did or didn't mention that Germany had told their citizens to switch to Firefox.
Yeah, I don't think we had said that. Actually, did they say switch to Firefox, or did they say
they did
use some other browser?
I think they said some other browser like Firefox. Firefox got a mention.
Okay.
France has since joined the party in telling their citizens to say no to IE.
No.
They're good at that.
Oops. Good French accent there, Bart.
So that was earlier in the week. Then some security researchers pointed out that although the current attacks were against IE6 and Microsoft was busy saying that IE8 is the most secure browser on the internet, that actually with some very small tweaks they actually would work on IE7 and 8, so that it's only a matter of time until they become targeted too.
Yeah.
Then Microsoft ate some humble pie and rushed out an emergency patch to the most secure browser on the internet, which had a zero-day flaw in it.
So the patch is out, though.
The patch came out on Thursday.
Oh, okay.
They announced it on Wednesday.
Okay, well, that's good. They have the patch out. It's faster than Apple would have done it, I guess.
It depends, but yeah, Apple, yeah. So far, Apple haven't really been the target of something like this.
Now, what I really enjoyed was the uptick in downloads. According to the Wall Street Journal, after Germany sent its warning out, 4 days after that, it said, Mozilla says it receives 300,000 incremental downloads above its typical downloading rate over that time period, that 4 days. And Opera also went up. They said the number of downloads in Germany of its Opera browser doubled to 18,000 a day over the weekend. So that was kind of fun. Go Opera.
That number is interesting. In the horrendous difference between 300,000 and 18,000.
Well, 18,000 was per day, and the 300,000 was over 4 days, so you really got to go 72,000 versus 300,000. That's pretty good for Opera.
Yeah, but it's not even a third.
I know, but I've never even met anybody who used Opera.
Firefox's 25% share. I mean...
Sure. I'm not saying, but hey, go Opera. You know, I like competition. Yeah, okay.
That's true. So that's our friends in Redmond. So it's very good time to fire up your VMs, or if you're a Windows user, allow that patch to come in. We had a meeting, and for various reasons that I don't want to go into because it's just so depressing, but our building is in a state of flux where we now have no meeting room because it's become reception, and we now have to meet in the computer lab. So it means the undergraduates don't get to use computers while we have meetings. But we were all sitting in the room talking away about some boring thing about our quality review process. And every single machine in the entire lab rebooted at the same time when the patch came out.
Oh, was it loud?
There was like every machine's BIOS beep. It was like beep, 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 beep.
Oh, jeez. over the lab.
It was funny.
Nice.
So yeah, definitely update yourself on this one.
All right. Is that it?
No.
There's more.
Exactly. Our good old friends in Adobe, not to be outdone, since they're clearly rivaling Microsoft for the badge for least secure company in the world. Another nasty security exploit, cross-platform again. This time it's just Windows and Mac, because I believe there is no Linux version of Shockwave. It's in the Shockwave version of Flash, which is old.
Oh, good.
And I don't think many Mac users will have Shockwave installed, but I do think Windows users are more likely to have it have snuck in over the years. So it might be no harm to get the update from Adobe to be sure you have the latest version anyway. But if you're on a Mac user, it maybe don't do it, because then you'll just be installing Shockwave and then you have Shockwave in your system. They're not good.
Run away. So maybe the answer is to uninstall Shockwave. Is that a better solution?
That's a very good solution. If you have Shockwave, uninstall it. Steve Gibson did a thing on figuring out whether or not you have Shockwave on Security Now, but I don't remember the exact episode number.
Okay.
Because his advice a couple of months ago, the last time Shockwave had something wrong with it, was just get rid of it. You don't need it.
All right.
And then finally, a new entry into our rogues gallery here. We have our friends at Real Media.
Are they still around?
Apparently.
The CEO left. I heard Rob Glaser actually left Real. He's not even there anymore.
Wow. Well, anyway, they still have Real Player, and they've released an emergency security update for that one.
Great.
Cross-platform usual business. So if on the off chance you have Real, update it. I'm not sure all that many people do these days.
Yeah, I don't. The last time I looked into it was when, right after All Things Digital, when Rob Glaser announced that they were going to be able to allow you to download videos from the internet if no one had told them not to, or something like that. There was a flag people could set to say, you can't download my video, but if nobody took action, this Real Player thing would be able to download it.
That obviously didn't work.
No, I don't think that worked out for him. It was a good idea, but didn't work out.
Okay, that's it, thankfully. Well, for the security light bit.
Okay, now let's get into security heavy. So I asked you to look into this for me because I didn't understand what it meant. About 235 people sent me a link to a story in England about a security flaw in the MiFi. So just anybody who hasn't been paying attention to this, the MiFi is a little half credit card sized little box that you carry around in your purse, and it gives you the internet in your purse, and it allows you to share out a wireless signal that you or share out through Wi-Fi a cell phone signal. So it's like a like an EVDO card, except it's a little box that sits on its own, and then it shoots out Wi-Fi for you. So I carry one in my purse, so everybody on Earth sent me the link to tell me, ha ha, it's hacked. But I didn't understand it. I wanted it explained in plain English to me. What's the hack?
Okay. I suppose the first thing we should say is that it's not clear exactly what all this hack affects, but the basic hack is that in theory, it's a router, so it has a web interface which you use to program the router and tell it things like what DNS server to use and whether to use WEP or WPA and what password to use, all that kind of stuff. And in theory, you should need to enter an admin password before you can do anything to change the configuration of the MiFi. The okay. practice, however, differs from the theory. The thing has a flaw in how it was implemented, which means that attackers can change the settings without the need for the password.
So I have a physical box in my possession mm-hmm. that is pulling down a signal from a cell phone tower.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's getting into it. That's like them getting into the router at my house, essentially.
It is, yeah.
So how? I don't get
through it. Your good old friend, the web browser.
Okay. There is a web browser interface, but I have to go to 192.168.blah-blah-blah and type in my credentials.
You do. But whenever you open a web page from the internet, everything in that web page executes from your machine, and your machine has access to that web interface. So using our good old friend's cross-site request forgery, someone just has to give you a web page with a image tag that points to 192.168, whatever, whatever, whatever. And since it's your browser that's going to go fetch that URL, and your browser is inside...
There we go. Okay, so I have to visit the site. They can't just, like, crawl through the air to get to my thing.
Yeah, you got to let them in by visiting a web page.
Okay, but that...
So once they're in, then, the admin bypass... So the fact that they don't actually need the password, even though they theoretically should, means that behind your back, they can start reconfiguring your router, and you won't see anything. It won't ask you for a password. It won't do anything. It will just... The MiFi will go, oh, okay, then I'll do that. The downside, well, what's getting the most publicity is that the MiFi contains a GPS chip, and the GPS chip can be turned on without the admin password, and the results of where you are can then be returned back to the attacker.
Now, that one doesn't bother me at all. So some hacker sitting in Zimbabwe hacks it, and I'm sitting in Istanbul, and it tells him I'm in Istanbul. So what?
Yeah, it probably doesn't affect most people, but if this is not a random attack that they're just looking for someone, but if it's a targeted attack, a so-called spear phishing attack, it can be exceptionally useful to know where exactly on this planet the person you'd like to kidnap to extort money out of them is.
Boy, is that specific, though. So it's got to be somebody phishing for somebody who has a MiFi. Not that okay, many, I mean, if everybody had a MiFi, maybe.
It was something that happens a lot in Ireland, annoyingly, disturbingly, in fact, is that people who work in banks get kidnapped and their family held to ransom, and they get sent into work and told, empty the safe and bring it back or your family die.
Ugh.
Yeah, ugh, exactly. But when they target someone, it's a specific target. You want a certain bank. So you send an email to someone in a certain bank with the link, and then suddenly you have a homing beacon on one of your targets.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not going to affect normal people, really. Like you say, do you really care if some randomer in some random country knows you're in some other random country? But if you're out to get someone specifically, this kind of thing is helpful.
I guess if it were a GPS in the iPhone that could be hacked that way, that would start to, you know, you get a large, large population with the device and, you know, the chances of someone you want to kidnap being in that list...
gets higher.
But so that means you've got to... Okay, so with this hack, let me make sure I understand. You have to want to get to me. You have to get me to go to a malicious web page, and I have to own and be using, at that instant in time, my MiFi. Not only own exactly. it, I have to be using it.
Yes.
Okay, that one doesn't worry me so much.
No, and it doesn't worry me so much either. What does worry me, and I haven't been able to find an explicit yes or no on whether this is the case... All I can find is people saying that you can reconfigure the settings of the MiFi. Well, is that all the settings or some of the settings? If it's all the settings, it's exceptionally worrying because that includes DNS.
Okay, right, right.
And if someone controls what IP address your computer thinks matches what name, they get to intercept, edit, read, and alter all of the data that you send.
Yeah, I don't want that one so much. And that one doesn't have to be targeted. It's got no weird characteristics to it at all.
It's a fantastic open door for an attacker. If they get to choose that all of your traffic goes through their server and they want to completely take you over, they simply start injecting other bits of malware into your random web pages. You go to CNN.com and they inject in a little IE Trojan. That didn't work. Okay, next time you go to Apple.com, we'll inject a Safari attack or we'll inject something else. They can just keep injecting malware until they get you.
Right.
Because they control all of your traffic can be diverted through their servers. So DNS takeover is just not good. It's like very bad.
Now the site,
so that worries me.
The site though that everybody sent me was this really weird site. It was like a transcription of an interview or of a chat session with the guy who had found this, and then there was this weird video that had no voice. It didn't explain what was going on. Just crap moving all over the screen. Couldn't figure it out. So it seemed like maybe this was fake at first.
No, that's the website of a nerd.
I mean,
the nerd in question who found the exploit.
A nerd beyond us. I mean,
yeah, it's a security researcher. Yeah, and other security researchers would look at that video and go, "Ooh,
okay."
Whereas we look at it and go, "Yeah,
yeah." So, did you find independent confirmation?
I did, because I didn't want to talk about this if all we had was one website of one nerd claiming to have found something.
Right.
But I found a link to a news article on a UK site, and that has quotes from the actual manufacturers of the MiFi admitting to the problem.
Oh, bummer.
Now, what they do interestingly say is there are multiple models of the MiFi, and we have a different one in Europe, and in particular in the UK on Vodafone or T-Mobile, than you guys have in the States. And the one we have doesn't have the authentication bypass, but it does have the cross-site request forgery. So if you're logged into the MiFi interface and you visit another web page, then they can take over. Whereas in the US, they can just take over.
Mm. Okay.
There is a solution, though. So this technically could have been dropped into Security Light. Use the thing over USB. Don't use it as a Wi-Fi. Use it as a 3G card and you're sorted.
Yeah, I guess. As a stopgap
measure. They're going to have to push out a new firmware.
Yeah, because that completely defeats the purpose of the MiFi if you have to do that.
I mean, it defeats it for a lot of purposes. Yeah, if you're an iPod Touch user using it to turn your iPod Touch into a pseudo iPhone, it completely and utterly defeats the purpose.
That's for sure.
But if you're a laptop user who just desperately needs to be able to get their email and stuff while they're on the go, at least this is a solution.
Yeah, right. Just to hold you over?
I hold you over. The other question that people ask is, well, how likely is it to end up on a malicious website? The answer is, unfortunately, more likely than you think because of the much more common practice now of people injecting malware into banner ads.
Oh,
so yeah. That's how, I think it was the New York Times. If it wasn't the NYT, it was a paper of similar repute. Where there was one Saturday a few months ago where they ended up with malware in their ads because they don't do the ads on their own site. They get some other ad agency to do it, and that ad agency, you know, is interested in making as much money as possible. So they're not all that interested in vetting the ads. They just want people to hand over cash.
Right. You know, the other thing I worry about a lot is the use of tiny URLs. I mean, somebody says they're going to be clever in Twitter. I'm going to click that link.
Yeah.
I don't spend the time I probably should going, I know there's like a Firefox extension that can let you check the SNP URL or some of those. And I'm just
let you see what it is before you go.
Yeah, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, that's definitely a common vector. And the other thing is people just clicking links in email. That's like a surefire way to end up places you don't want to go.
Bart, I am adamant. I never do that. I always check the URL, but then I'm over in Twitter going, hey, this could be funny. I'll click that.
Yeah.
But I never click them in email.
Yeah, I guess we don't perhaps want to dwell too much on this, but
yeah.
It's a legitimate concern if you're a MiFi user.
Yeah, I wanted to ask it for my own personal use, and I'm not sure it has great impact on everyone else in the world, but it was kind of fun. So we do have a fun topic, finally. Enough doom and gloom for now?
We do. Now, this, I have to stress, very importantly, these are my initial thoughts. This is not my final thought I'd consider review. This is what I think having used the product for, use it hard for a week and use it for 2 weeks.
Is this going to be one of those Mr. Cranky Pants?
This is a mixed review.
Okay.
So the product, as a Christmas present, the fantastic typical Mac user himself gave me a copy of Photoshop Elements 8.
That's pretty nice of Victor.
Yeah, I think it might have something to do with the fact that I contribute to a fair few of his shows.
But
I think that may be related. Yeah, I think that may be related.
A sign of appreciation.
No, Victor just asked me, you know, if I were to buy you Photoshop 8, would Elements 8, would you use it? And I said, well, yes. So he did.
How fun.
So now I have to use it. So I suppose the first thing I should say is I have a history of not being a giant fan of Adobe products.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair to say.
I believe that's come up a few times.
Yeah, so I generally consider them to be bloated, insecure, overpriced rubbish. Just not to put too fine a point on them.
And you also have a habit of hating everything when you first try it.
Not everything. There's some things I love when I first try them. But I usually do find something not to like.
Okay, so a 27-inch iMac. You'd like that right out of the box. That's about it, though, Mark. So anyway, okay.
But, you know, I do admit that I have a bit of a prejudice against Adobe stuff, but I am determined to give this a fair run of things. So, yes, historically, I have been very condescending of Adobe, but I'm determined to be fair to Photoshop Elements. So I just want to say that. So I've had it for 2 weeks. It took me a week just to get into the swing of it. And then the last week, I've actually been really using it rather than just sort of poking at it going, what? Why? Who? Which I have to say is the first reaction to the user interface. It's not a Mac app.
Really?
It runs on a Mac, but you could not, by any stretch of the imagination, describe it as a Mac app. It doesn't use anyone's standard UI elements apart, I guess, from Adobe's.
I guess that's hard for me to see because I've been using it for, you know, like 12 years. It seems like a typical Mac app because it's always been a Mac app to me.
Okay, well, it really doesn't follow any of the standard Mac UI stuff. It's not a Mac app.
Like what?
Well, I mean, if you look to the thing, it's if anything, it reminds me of sort of the stereotype of everything that's wrong with Windows. Sort of, if you take the assumption that an app that has lots of buttons must be very powerful, and therefore an app that has no buttons must be very unpowerful, it's very obvious that Adobe wanted to leave people in no doubt whatsoever how powerful this app was.
Give me an example. What do you mean?
There's buttons everywhere. It's just this barf of buttons that are up the side, they're across the top, they're down the other side, and I have no idea what any of them do. There's no logic, rhyme, or reason. They're just buttons.
So you don't think it looks like Pixelmator or Acorn any of those?
No, it really doesn't, because they have much, much, much Pixelmator. When you open it up, you just get one little palette of very obvious icons, which are, you know, crop, select, paintbrush. I mean, they're very obvious icons. And you just have one palette of them and just floating there.
Okay, I'm going to challenge you on this. Wait a minute. What about, what is that drawing tool that you like so much, the OmniGraffle? That has a barf of buttons. It has buttons down the side and buttons across the top. It has palettes that open up that are all barfed up with buttons, and I can't tell what any of them do.
Actually, there's very few buttons in the top of the interface. You have the palettes with which you choose which ones you see and which ones you don't see, which, I mean, every image editor has your palettes, which you choose to hide and unhide depending as you want them. But in Elements, you just have this whole array of buttons everywhere. It actually, I found that really quite confusing. I just wanted to open an image, and it was just, I didn't like it at all.
I'm going to count the buttons on OmniGraffle and Photoshop Elements.
it's not only quantity, it's also how they're just sort of laid out. So I wasn't particularly happy about that interface style, but I imagine if you use a lot of Adobe products, I'm going to assume that if you go from Lightroom to Elements to Real Photoshop to whatever their video editing stuff are, I'm going to assume that Adobe have consistency throughout their product. So the chances are, if you've been using Adobe products for years, you're going to love this interface because it's what you're used to.
By the way, I do want to stick in a point here. I don't use Photoshop Elements anymore. So I'm not actually a big fan. I just disagree with you on that exact point. But okay, so fair enough.
The other thing that annoys me because it has its own style of interface, and then randomly interspersed are OS X standard dialogues. Some of them.
Like,
so 1 minute the dialogue's Adobe style, the next minute the dialogue's Apple style, the next minute it's Adobe style again. It's like, where am I? What am I doing?
What are examples of Adobe versus Apple dialogue boxes. What do you mean?
Well, the Adobe dialogue boxes are the black ones. And then every now and then you get a standard Apple file open dialogue box popping up and a standard Apple okay dialogue box popping up.
Okay. I got you. Right.
It's just weird. So I'm not particularly fond of the interface, but that's probably not a surprise because it's fair to say I'm a fairly strong critic of user interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's being reasonable. The other thing is it doesn't play nicely with spaces.
Oh.
So it uses pretend windows, and it does the Firefox trick of when the window is a standalone window, it puts the what looks like OS X bars across it, and so it looks like an OS X window. But it actually isn't, because if you pick it up and drag it to the edge of a space, it won't change.
Hmm.
You can bang it off the edge of that screen till the cows come and it will not chase. You can also click it, drag it, and do control whatever to go to whatever space. It won't come with you. The only way I've found to move spaces is to go to the F8 view, which shows all spaces, and then pick it up and dump it into the other space.
Nice. That's
the other
handy.
Thing, of course. Yeah, exactly. So it has a main window, and when you... I had that open in one space, and I had my Finder window in another space, and I right-clicked and went open with Photoshop Elements. And what I would expect to happen with an OS X app is that I'd be whooshed off to the space where the app is, and it would open. So what happened instead is it got the standalone window in my current space, and it took me ages to figure out that I had to use F8 to try get it to join its compatriots.
Nice.
So that annoyed me a little, but I guess if you're used, it's the kind of thing you just get used to it and you just sidestep that landmine once you're used to it. But it does again show that it's not really a Mac app. It's just pretending.
Okay. Go use the GIMP for a couple hours and come back and you'll appreciate it.
Oh, no, the GIMP is even worse.
Well, that's what I mean.
The GIMP isn't a Windows app.
I don't even know what the GIMP
app.
Is.
It's a Linux app pretending to be a Mac app.
It might even be a Linux app pretending to be a Windows app pretending to be a Mac app. Every window completely independent. You can quit one and you're still in the application. But anyway.
You know, you will never, ever find me saying that the GIMP is a piece of UI genius.
It's free, though.
It is free, though. You get what you pay for in some regards.
I actually, this week, successfully made a black rectangle with white text on it where I wanted the text to be in the GIMP.
Congratulations.
There have been days I haven't succeeded, and I've gone, screw it, I'll go home, use my Mac, and mail it to myself at work, you know?
Well, the GIMP in Windows, at least, doesn't have that silly X11 carry-on. So the GIMP in Windows is a less bad app than the GIMP on the Mac. The GIMP on the Mac is about as bad as it gets.
Okay.
Anyway, that's I'm not going to compare this to the GIMP. This is, like, yards ahead of the GIMP.
Just wanted to be fair.
The other thing... the other thing you're always ever presently aware of is that this is a crippled application. Adobe have intentionally stripped out features because if this app is too good, you're just not going to buy their expensive app.
Hmm. I have to disagree with you on this one.
But how can you disagree? That's just the fact. It's a light version of Photoshop.
It's a fact that it is, but to me, it's not at all obvious it's crippled because I've never used real Photoshop, so I don't know what I'm missing. So I don't feel like it's crippled at all.
I find it's crippled even compared to Pixelmator. And in particular, I've bumped into two of these things that are just, to me, utterly arbitrary, and they're purely there as a punitive measure to make power users want to buy the more expensive product. So in my mind, Pixelmator is striving to be the best possible editor it can, and Elements is striving to be a good editor, but not a great editor, because if it's a great editor, then that takes away business from Photoshop for real.
But I think it has included in it 95% of what a normal person would need that is not a photo expert, you know, working in, you know, requiring CMYK for print screening and all that kind of stuff.
I don't know. I guess it depends on the level you're at. Many people compare Photoshop Elements to Pixelmator because they're in a very similar price category. And so it's not an unreasonable comparison to draw. The first one I bumped headlong into, like splat into a wall, is that it doesn't actually support true layer masking, which is something that almost every photographic technique nowadays has because it's such a great way to do things. So you have some layer masks in Elements, which just makes it even more annoying. If you happen to choose an adjustment layer from the rather small list of types of adjustment layers you can have, you get to apply that adjustment using a layer mask. But if you just have a regular layer of your own making, you don't get to use layer masks on that.
Hmm.
So yeah, we have all of the ability to do layer masking. It's all built into this program. But slap, you're not allowed to use it there. You're allowed to use it there.
Okay.
That's clearly arbitrary, because it's not that the functionality is not there. It's just that they're not giving it to you in certain instances.
See, what makes I've it never even been sillier, able to figure out layer masking. I've read about it. I've read all the manuals. I've pulled books. I've studied it, and I've never figured out what to even use it for.
It's a way of making your layer selectively more or less transparent in different places by painting on it with different shades of gray, white, and black.
Wow. I never got that from everything I read.
That's literally it. So you make a version of your image which has some sort of thing done to it, and you want to blend that in with the original. Anywhere you color black will become completely... Is it opaque or transparent? I always get this backwards, so just go with me. Okay. Anything you paint completely black will be completely opaque, and so the top version will completely block the bottom version. Anything you paint completely white will be completely transparent, and anything you paint different shades of grey will be somewhere in between. So you can very subtly blend them, because there won't be a sharp line between this is from one version, this is from the other version. You use a soft-edged brush to give you the shades of grey, and you can really gently merge from one end to the other.
So you kind of need to be an artiste of some sort.
If you're a Pixelmator user, that's what you're going to be doing.
No, that's not true, Bart. I disagree. Most of us use things like Pixelmator or Acorn, I think, to do things like you've got this beautiful picture of your family in the ocean, but there's some dweeb behind you, you know, picking his nose, and you just use the, you know, use the clone tool to erase the guy, or you realize that this fantastic picture of your kid has an outlet in the background, or, you know.
Okay, that's Acorn is definitely the right app for that. I consider that to be a very underpowered use of Pixelmator. So actually, maybe Acorn is a much better comparison app for Photoshop Elements than Pixelmator is.
I think I'll spend more time at Pixelmator, because they seemed like about the same kind of thing. They all felt about the same. Photoshop Elements and Pixelmator and Acorn feel the same to me.
Pixelmator's trying to be Photoshop real, and it's doing a pretty good job of it.
Maybe I haven't used it lately.
Acorn is trying to be an image editor for normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And Photoshop Elements is trying to be both. Actually, there's something...
No, Photoshop Elements is not trying to be Photoshop. No, you just said it tried to be Photoshop, and it's not.
It tries to be Photoshop Lite.
Yes.
That's what the expert view is. The advanced view in Photoshop Elements is Photoshop Lite.
Okay.
Anyway, I just want to quickly say that you can trick it into doing pretend layer masks using the faux layer masking technique. And people have even written that as a plugin, so you can actually just use their plugin, which then gives you effectively real layer masks. So the whole thing is utterly arbitrary and just designed to annoy you. The other stupid hurdle is that it won't open a 16-bit TIFF, but it will open an 8-bit TIFF.
How does one ever run into a 16-bit or an 8-bit TIFF? Where would that have happened?
16-bit TIFF is the normal way that Aperture exports a file to pass it from one editor to another.
That's a setting you must have set, I think.
No, it's its normal way. It also uses 8-bit when it has to. But a 16-bit TIFF is a very normal way to, without any loss, because you don't want to export your image as a JPEG and then bring it into another program. That's just a really bad idea. So TIFFs are the way you go with that. And a 16-bit TIFF will preserve so much more of your color space than an 8-bit TIFF will.
So I've really never run into that option when I've edited in an external editor. Is it just switching it to 8-bit on me when I go into Acorn and just not telling me that?
Acorn is probably happily opening the 16-bit. I've yet to come across anything that would just arbitrarily say, no, not doing 16-bits.
Except for Photoshop Elements?
Except for Photoshop Elements.
Huh.
It's just one of those arbitrary things of, we must differentiate this product, therefore I'm going to strip out functionality, and that 16-bit stuff, like the CMYK stuff, we've got to get rid of that. Anyway, so that's enough bad stuff.
Okay. Again, Aperture is not a low-end, regular, normal user application, in my opinion.
No. But anyway, okay. I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle. I don't think I'm alone at my angle. Anyway.
No, you're not.
So firstly, some good stuff. Some important good stuff.
Okay.
Even though they've stripped out stuff like layer masks, which are not particularly big power features, they've added in insanely powerful features, like jaw-dropping stuff that's really cutting-edge that only went into the real Photoshop one or two versions ago. Like the Recompose feature. Have you seen this?
No, uh-uh.
This is new. I think this is probably new in Elements 8. It normally if you take an image that's landscape and you drag it to be portrait, everything gets squashed and it looks horrible and distorted and useless.
Of course.
The recompose feature intelligently figures out what's the subject and what's just background, and when you resize it, the subject stays undistorted and the background distorts.
Really?
And so you can take a landscape shot of three people fairly far apart on a beach, drag in the edge, turn it into a portrait, and the three people come closer together.
No way. And they don't, get all squashed.
They don't get mushed.
Really?
Yeah, the beach gets mushed, but sand squished looks like sand.
Huh. Wow.
That's, or trees squished like trees. Yeah, I mean, it is
bizarre.
That's
quite an algorithm.
It's really powerful stuff, like really state of the art. And that's in there, but no layer masks. They also have things
Think about it. That's a normal human kind of thing want to do. That's someone playing with their snapshots might want to do something like that.
Sure, but it's also a very powerful feature that power users would be interested in.
Oh, yeah.
And another nice one is if you take, you know, the way if you would have a picture of your, say, yourself behind the bright building, and you're going to get the exposure mixed up so that, you know, the building is properly exposed, but you're all dark and silhouetted or vice versa.
Sure.
This thing will sort of intelligently adapt brightness so that you and the building look right.
Really?
Yeah. And then there's also features that will find all the faces, so you can have different versions of the same group shot and it'll pick the best face for everyone.
Oh, no way. That's something I wanted.
Yeah, so I haven't played with all these. These are all very proudly put on the box, and I've been watching some videos of these things in action. I just haven't had a use for them yet, so I haven't really tested them. But these are serious power features.
See, I took 28 pictures of our family for our Christmas portrait that I made into a very funny video, of course. But when I was finally done, I had this picture that I liked of everybody but me. So I used Acorn to go over and grab myself and paste myself in the way I wanted myself to look, and not anybody noticed. But it would have been nice if Photoshop Elements just did it for me.
Yeah, so, you know, there's some really powerful stuff in there. And then the other thing I definitely want to get to is that there's not one interface to Photoshop Elements. There's three.
Right.
So you choose between the different views, which means that if I was looking for an app for the proverbial mother, I'm going to use my own as an example.
Oh, you say that, and I'm going to spank you. You know how I hate that, Bart.
Yeah, that's... I would also say that I'll apply it for my father as well, who also is a Photoshop Elements user and is very happy as a Photoshop Elements user. But if you have someone who is not interested in becoming a photo geek, but who still wants to edit photos, who isn't a computer geek and has no interest in becoming a computer geek, but they still want to edit photos, then the basic interfaces in Elements are bloody brilliant.
Hmm.
They're entirely task-oriented. What do you want to do? I want to resize the picture. Click here. I mean, they're grouped into different tasks, and you just choose a task, and then the interface walks you through that task.
You know, I found that really irritating.
You're a power user.
Right. That's probably why. But it's just like, yeah, it never did what I wanted it to do.
But is that because you wanted it to do a lot more? I mean, if you were to put the advanced interface in front of someone with very little computer experience, they would get nowhere, and they would hate it.
Sure.
Whereas if you gave them that interface, they'd get stuff done.
Right, yeah, good
They point. Get nice stuff done. So that, I mean, as much as I'm never going to use those features, I am going to lock it on the advanced interface.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it has to be said that it's a very good feature that they have those multiple interfaces.
Would you buy them a tool that expensive, though, if they were a beginner? I guess it gives them the opportunity to grow up.
Yeah, exactly. It will grow with them because you go from, there's three interfaces. So you have very beginning, middle and beginning, and then the advanced interface.
Sure.
So yeah, it will grow with them, which is good.
That's true.
So I definitely want to get that in there because that's definitely good. The other thing that's very powerful is that it supports Photoshop plugins.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a way to spend a lot of money.
Okay. They're not all very expensive. I keep on plugging our friends at Topaz.
Mm-hmm.
But it's... Like, you can use the Topaz plugins directly from Aperture using Topaz Fusion. It's a bit of a hack. It does work, but I'll tell you something. It's a lot more fun to do it from within Photoshop Elements.
Oh, really?
Which is where it was. Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
The integration is tighter, and because Photoshop Elements supports layers, I inevitably find that as much as I love Topaz, and no matter how carefully and subtly I adjust the sliders, there's always a slightly harsh look to the output I don't like. So what I do is I blend it with the original by just sliding the transparency down to about 75%. It gives me 25% original and 75% new. And that seems to be a nice balance. And that results in really natural looking photos that I promise you I could show you and you'd never think they'd been run through any sort of fancy editors. They just look natural. They don't look effecty.
Now, I want to make sure we use the correct terminology here. On they're not all expensive. Even the ones at Topaz are $50. So you're talking about three-quarters the price of Photoshop Elements to add one plug-in to it.
Or yeah, but I remember I got the entire set of Topaz plugins for $150.
So for twice the cost of Photoshop Elements. So I mean, to me, that's a plugin ought to be, you know, 5-10% the price of the actual software. That just seems like it seems huge. And our friend Robert Lachman from PhotoInTheMac.com, he's always talking about these plugins. Going, yeah, I know it's really cool, but it's like $180. He always apologizes, but he'll go, no, but it's really cool.
The thing is, these are tools that are written for professionals in the full big, you know, the big boys Photoshop, but they work in here. So you get to sneak in some really powerful features that way. Like the Nick software stuff is expensive because it's really pro level stuff, but bloody hell is it powerful. And you can just stick it into Photoshop Elements.
That's true.
So to me, that's a very good feature. And I have to say that no matter what else happens, no matter how much I end up liking or hating Photoshop Elements 8, I am going to use it every time I want to use the Topaz plugins. I'm much happier using that as my workflow.
Oh, that's
so export
good.
From round trip from Aperture to Photoshop Elements rather than from Aperture to Topaz. And then use Elements to get out the Topaz functionality in round trip and send it back.
Oh, that's good.
So, I mean, I really like that. And the other thing is I have actually been using it for some more powerful edits. And once you adjust your workflow to work by sort of taking bits of one layer and putting them in another layer to pretend have layer masking, sort of, you can actually do some very powerful stuff with it. And the tools are comfortable to use. The shortcut keys are really intuitive and you get into them very quickly. And, you know, the tools for selecting and stuff, they're just nice. Like, you know, you have the magic wand selection tool and then you have the option to feather the selection so you don't get a harsh edge. It works very nicely. And I have to say, I did enjoy editing images as long as I was able to sidestep the ever-present lack of the layer masks, which now that I have this workaround, probably isn't going to annoy me as much anyway. And I guess ultimately that's kind of what it's about, is editing images.
I'm a big fan of the keystrokes like you talked about. I read a book and I was just trying to read across the room the name of the author. It escapes me right now, but he did a great Photoshop Elements book where one of the things he said was, if you're being paid by the hour, I'd like you now to reach your right hand out to your mouse and slowly drag it up to the menu bar and click on this button and pull over to the right and click. Now, if you're being paid by the job, I want you to hit the letter K, and now you've changed the background to black.
Yeah.
And I always remember that. And so, I mean, they're wonderful keystrokes. And a lot of those are true in other editors. They've just stolen the same character. Like, I mean, you expect to be able to hit Z for zoom, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Z for zoom, S for the stamp tool. That was mainly what I was doing, zooming in and zooming out and cloning.
Yeah, I think there's one... Yeah, the cloning is good. I love the clone tool. Oh, another one you were excited about, you haven't mentioned, was the magic selection tool.
Yeah, the magic wand selection tool is fantastic. So you start dragging across what you want to select, and it starts to find stuff. It looks for the edges, basically. It just expands your selection out to the edges. If it gets it wrong, you just hold down the Option key and drag in from the edges, and you just refine it back in. And even if the edge isn't very clear, if it goes too far over and then you push it back, it tends to get it right on the way back. And you can really very quickly and very easily mask out, select rather than mask out, very bizarre shapes within your image. I mean, it works very nicely. Now, and then when you have your selection, you can refine the selection. So the first thing you would do is you would grow the selection and it just expands in every direction. And then you feather it, and that means that it has a fade from the edge of the selection to not the edge of the selection. So then if you, you know, drop that in another image, it will fade in much better because it fades away to transparency.
Right, right. The feather stuff is great.
Yeah, it's really nice, and it shows you where it is and isn't applying the feather by using this lovely red overlay. So you can see the darker the red overlay, the more of it is and isn't selected. So it's a nice interface. It was very pleasant to work in. I have to say I really enjoyed that bit of it.
You know, I haven't used Photoshop Elements 8. I forget what the last version I used was, but I kept paying the $100 every year to get the update. And it was kind of like, well, you know, got tired of paying for it when I was not seeing a great benefit. But I do know the last version I used, they actually showed in the demo how you could use the Magic Selection tool. And they showed a guy leaning up against a tree where his hair was almost exactly the same color as the tree. And the Magic Selection tool could tell him apart.
Yeah.
Like hair was different
than
bark.
Detection.
Yeah.
You know, it's very cool stuff. I just really enjoyed using it, I have to say. So, you know, it's got a lot of power to it that way. So whenever you're not banging into the edges, it's very nice. And then as soon as you say, oh, I just need to mask, you'll flip. So until you bang into an edge, it's all very pleasant.
As long as you play inside the garden where they want you.
As long as you stay in the sandbox.
You know, they've really dropped the price on this. I was just checking to buy Photoshop Elements outright is $80 now after a $20 mail-in rebate.
Yeah.
It used to be $100 to upgrade.
Okay, well, that's definitely wise of them.
Well, I think things like Pixelmator and Acorn being out, you know, Pixelmator's around $60, and I forget what Acorn costs. I think it's more like $50.
Yeah, Acorn's a bit cheaper than Pixelmator.
But still, those are all, I mean, that's within a margin of error from $50 to $80, and you've got some really nice choices now. Maybe that competition has actually helped Photoshop Elements come down in price.
Yeah, it must impact it, because, I mean, on the Mac, you have to include Pixelmator in when you're choosing your editor, you can't not include it in your list of choices.
Right, right.
Well, it gives serious competition.
We've been going on a long time. Bottom line it for us, Bart.
Bottom line it, if I were to be a beginner, I would like Photoshop Elements. If I were to be an iPhoto user looking for the next step, Photoshop Elements would be a good choice. If I'm looking for a replacement for real Photoshop, probably still stick with Pixelmator for now.
All right. Well, that's fun to hear your viewpoint on it. I always like to yank your chain on your, on your criticisms. I even yanked your chain when you liked stuff, so that was fun.
Yeah, no, just to say, this is just preliminary, and I'm going to be keeping using this app. I'm not stopping just at this basic stage, so expect to hear more, and I'm probably going to change my mind on things.
All right, good. All right, we on for next week look good?
Next week look perfectly normal, so until then, happy computing.
Well, I hope you made it all the way through the show. I guess if you're hearing me, that means you made it all the way through the show. I did promise an action-filled adventure, didn't I? If you'd like to contribute a recording or send in a dumb question or shower me with compliments or even give a helpful suggestion for improvement, send me an email at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow my nonsense all week long on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.